Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Mark is the founder, president, and CEO of Community Health Center Incorporated, a provider of primary healthcare services for the uninsured and underserved with 170 service locations in Connecticut. Margaret is senior vice president and clinical director of CHC and is a family nurse practitioner by profession. Conversations on Healthcare is a weekly look at the people and ideas that are transforming the delivery of healthcare in America. And this week, Mark and Margaret are joined by Susan Dentzer, Editor-in-Chief of Health Affairs, a peer-reviewed journal focusing on healthcare policy. In the Tech Report segment, you'll hear about technology that provides expectant mothers with health information via text message. And we begin with this week's bright idea. Here's Margaret Flinter.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. This week's bright idea comes to us from Afghanistan, where a new midwifery training program is making childbirth safer in a country with the second highest maternal and infant mortality rate in the world. The program was created by JAPIGO, an international health organization affiliated with Johns Hopkins University. This nonprofit has a track record empowering frontline health workers for almost four decades, and its efforts have improved healthcare for women and children in more than 140 countries worldwide. 6 years ago, JAPIGO developed a plan to provide remote mountain villages in Afghanistan, often very far away from health clinics, with the resources that they needed to stop preventable deaths in childbirth. JAPIGO has worked with Afghanistan's Ministry of Public Health to increase the number of village health clinics and to establish accredited midwifery schools in every province of the country. Now, young women can attend an 18-month midwifery training course in their provincial capital. And although women are not typically allowed to have jobs or travel alone in traditional Afghan society, a new system has been developed where village health councils enable the community leaders to choose which women will receive the training based on their aptitude and interest and their relationship with the community. The women return as midwives to their villages, respected and ready to provide a full spectrum of prenatal delivery and postpartum health services. By training midwives to provide the delivery support and the infant care education that new mothers need, JAPIGO is strengthening Afghanistan's healthcare system and improving maternal and infant survival rates across the country. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. Today we're speaking with Susan Dentzer, Editor-in-Chief of Health Affairs, the nation's leading journal on health policy. Welcome, Susan.
Great to be with you.
Susan, there are so many wonderful things to say about health affairs, but every month you offer expert, thoughtful commentary on a range of important healthcare and health policy issues. In January 2010, Health Affairs redesigned, or should I say reinvented itself, and your timing nicely aligned with our country's renewed focus on health reform and has been a boon for the growing audience of people yearning to be better informed. Can you share with us your vision on how Health Affairs fits into the broader discussion of healthcare and how you hope to shape these discussions?
The tagline for our journal is that we are at the intersection of health, healthcare, and policy. And we take that very seriously. We think it's really important to be at that intersection and to be essentially a neutral party in communicating among the various entities in that intersection. Let me give you an example of what I mean. We know, for example, that if you look at what contributes to premature death in the United States, why do people die before their eventual life expectancy would tell you that they are likely to die? You know, why do so many people have chronic illness and die at younger ages than others? And as we know, we have a 33-year or more difference in life expectancy in this country, depending on who you are, what your racial and ethnic background is, what your level of educational attainment is, or that of your parents was, et cetera. So if you ask, why do some people die earlier than others? We know some of it has to do with your genetic predispositions, but that's relatively speaking only 30% of the contribution probably. Your behavior has a lot more to do with it, whether you are eating right, exercising, etc. Your social circumstances have a big role. 15% or more of your likelihood that you'll die early has to do with what is your status in life? What is your level of educational attainment or your overall socioeconomic level? And only a relatively minor contributor to that whole equation is whether or not you got adequate medical care. So you put all of that in a big stew, and what do you have? You have where we're born, who we are, what our education was, what our parents' education was. All of those things have as much, if not more, an impact on your actual health status than your health care. So it's very important to have a place where we talk about all of those things. What are the contributors to our overall level of health in this country? What is the role of health care in all of that? And what can we do with health care to maximize health, given all the other things that contribute to our health? And then very importantly, what should our policy be at the state, at the federal, at the local level to maximize our health? Because we could all agree that what we really want is for our population to be as healthy as possible and therefore able to contribute to the advancement of society and live, but really pursue life, liberty, and happiness.
You know, during the health reform debates, we often heard Americans want a uniquely American solution, but probably a lot for us to learn from other countries. What would you say are some of the key lessons that we could learn both from the healthcare system and the health policies in other countries?
Well, it is certainly the case that, you know, the thing we have in common with people of other countries is we are all people. And obviously, there are a number of things that stem from the fact that we all have this essentially the same basic biology, and so that with respect to all the industrialized countries, the things that afflict us afflict them. So chronic illness, the fact that so many of us have cardiovascular disease, are fighting overweight or obesity, have high blood pressure, the other factors that feed into cardiovascular disease, and very importantly, are battling cancers, those are universal across, first of all, across the world increasingly, but certainly with respect to the industrialized countries. So to the degree that other countries are trying to figure out how to develop health and healthcare systems that grapple with these chronic illnesses, these non-communicable illnesses, we just have a lot to learn with from other countries. Every industrialized country is struggling with how to do that well. So we're kind of in this vicious cycle at this point in this country, and other countries feel that they are getting close to that too. So to the degree that other countries are figuring out ways to try to restrain the cost of health care or even lower the cost of health care, we've got some opportunities to learn from them as well.
Let's talk a little bit about some of those big challenges that you've laid out in terms of rising cost and limited resources here in the United States and our effort to improve our own healthcare system. And Health Affairs has written about the unfinished business of the Affordable Care Act. And as we know, the act has some hidden gems embedded within it and also has some gaping holes. Can you share us with your thoughts on both of those?
Yes, I think very much the unfinished business is what we are all really grappling with right now, because despite what a lot of the pundits and pontificators say, you will frequently hear the statement made that the Affordable Care Act did nothing to restrain the rate of growth of health costs. And that's really not accurate. What the Affordable Care Act did, though, was set up a series of very elaborate experiments that we can undertake to try to figure out how to restrain the rate of growth of health costs. The important point to make here is if we knew exactly how to do this and to do it in a way that was in sync with our other values, believe me, we would have done it as Americans. All of the struggle here is figuring out how we do this and how we get the other things that we want. For example, we obviously want innovation in healthcare. And, we want better drugs. We want better devices. We don't want so much of that we crowd out the spending on the things that we think will influence health in the long run, as I've just said. So how do we have an environment where we have a lot of innovation in healthcare and healthcare products and services, but we still have that at affordable cost? That's a really tough issue. How do we have what we want in terms of access to healthcare without breaking the bank? And who decides? We know that this country reviles at the notion of rationing at the governmental level. Well, then what's the alternative if we're not going to ration at the governmental level overall? Again, if people had figured all of this out and could codify it into law, believe me, it would have been done. So what the Affordable Care Act does is says, okay, let's set up some experiments of new kinds of systems that operate in a different way than we have operated our system so far, and let's see if those work. And some of those systems that now people are hearing a lot about are, for example, so-called accountable care organizations. And what this really is an attempt to create a healthcare delivery system that, first of all, is not paid the way our current system is paid. We pay healthcare providers nowadays mostly on what's called a fee-for-service basis. So every little thing that a doctor does, he bills separately for. And you can imagine what this leads to. As George Bernard Shaw once memorably said, if you pay surgeons to chop off legs, each leg, you're going to have a society with lots of amputees. It's just inherent in the process. Even well-meaning, they'll just find reasons why it's probably in your best interest to have your leg cut off. That's what fee-for-service does. It incentivizes volume. So we're looking at new ways of paying systems that doesn't do that. The second thing we're doing is trying to figure out ways of rewarding healthcare delivery systems so they actually improve our health and so that these systems are rewarded because they improve our health or keep us healthy. Now, you would say, well, why didn't we think of that before? Well, for various reasons, we structured a system where what incentives do hospitals have? They have incentives to fill up their hospital beds and get paid. Wouldn't it be a wonderful thing if we had a system where hospitals were paid to keep themselves empty? You know, ideally, we want to keep people out of the hospital as much as possible, especially in the context of chronic illness. We want to keep you so healthy that you don't have to go into the hospital. So figuring out a way to incentivize a healthcare delivery system to keep us as healthy as possible really becomes the name of the game. And so that's what the Affordable Care Act does. It sets up these big, important national experiments to figure out if we can try to create systems where we pay people to keep us healthy or as healthy as possible. Hopefully, we continue to incentivize innovation, and we do it in a way that distributes the care more equitably than we have historically, because we're also giving coverage to the people who were previously uninsured. That's a pretty important set of experiments, and that's the unfinished, that's the overall most important unfinished business of health reform.
And that is a very good overview of those issues. You know, Susan, we're no surprise to you, probably we're both devoted readers of health affairs, and we've certainly observed that you've really kept a spotlight on the issue of the need for transformation of primary care and examples of where primary care has been transformed. And almost from the beginning of the patient-centered medical home recognition programs and standards, we've seen a lot of focus on that. So as the editor-in-chief, I'd like to ask you this question. Is the transformation of primary care, from your view, a sweeping transformation across the country or a slow crawl to a very uncertain outcome or somewhere in between at this point?
I think it's probably closer at this point. Let's put it this way. To this date, it's been a slow crawl. I think the crawl is picking up a lot of momentum now because it is very, very clear. The evidence shows unequivocally that if you have systems that of primary care that are really vibrant and very importantly, well enough funded that they can be vibrant, those systems produce better health and better health care and cost less, very importantly. And what we have done without intending to really in this country is we've let our primary care system, such as it is, first of all, not become a non-system, a non-functional system, and pretty much atrophy. And why have we done this? You know, somebody's going to do some deep historical investigations someday and figure out how it happened, but I think briefly, what happened is we put a lot of stock in very, very sophisticated and very advanced medicine. We structured a payment system that tends to reward that type of medicine. And we just forgot that we really need to pay people on the front end better than we do. And in particular, because a lot of primary care is not intervention oriented. You know, in a perfect world, your primary care doctor is saying things to you like, you really have to have a very sensible and appropriate diet. You really have to exercise appropriately. You really cannot smoke. A lot of those prevention-oriented things we either haven't paid primary care to do, or we have paid them very poorly to do. And meanwhile, we pay extraordinarily high rates for people to get, say, stents inserted in their hearts once they're very serious heart blockages or what have you. So we kind of have to tilt the system back and say, you know what, it really matters to have primary care people who are very, very competent and well compensated, or compensated well enough that they can stay in business and make a go of it. And that is, and what we see now is a movement to, as you said, the so-called patient-centered medical home, or as it's sometimes called in a way that seems to scare people less, the advanced primary care practice. And that's where you where in essence you have individuals who have a close relationship with a team of healthcare providers who are focused on their primary care. It may or may not be led by a physician, it may be led by a nurse practitioner. It could very frequently involve very intensive regular connections with not just nurses and nurse practitioners, but also community health workers. Because goodness knows we have plenty of examples where sort of peer relationships with community health workers, talking to people in their communities, helping them understand the importance of good diets and exercise. And if they have chronic illness, say, being adherent to their medication regimens and things like that, sometimes just dealing with a peer is more effective in having people have those kinds of behaviors than talking to a physician about it. So we can put together teams like this, primary care teams, that really work very closely with individuals in their communities to keep them as healthy as possible and to address whatever illnesses that they do have. And over time, if we make that investment, I think it's fairly clear that we can keep people healthier. The literature shows that. And that we will probably have cost savings at the end of the line as a consequence of doing that.
This is Conversations in Healthcare. Today we're speaking with Susan Dentzer, Editor-in-Chief of Health Affairs, the nation's leading journal on health policy. Susan, Health Affairs has a commitment to highlighting research and quality improvement, and yet at the same time you've noted our country's unexplainable devotion to healthcare of little or no proven value. What role do you see Health Affairs taking in shaping the public's understanding of the use and value around research and quality?
Well, 2 points. One is, as your comments just noted, we spend a lot of money on stuff that we have no evidence or no direct evidence, I should say, that it really works. And the Institute of Medicine has made this point in its assessment of where we should put our resources in terms of comparative effectiveness research. And that's a scary thought. We're the world's biggest spender on healthcare, far and away the biggest spender on a per capita basis, and yet half of what we're doing, but we have no direct evidence that it works. So shedding more light, first of all, on the importance of this comparative effectiveness research, and then importantly, once the research takes place, really getting it into the community and incorporated into practice, and enabling patients to have a role in making decisions among the choices available to them. All of that becomes very, very important. So we have spent a good deal of time focused on that issue. We devoted a whole issue to comparative effectiveness research in 2010, and we will continue to focus on the creation of the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute that was created under the Affordable Care Act, and the activities that will flow forward from the comparative effectiveness research that will take place over time under the auspices of the National Institutes of Health and the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. So that's one point. Second point is just on the quality of the care that we deliver. We know we have a long way to go. Our April 2011 issue was devoted to that subject. The famous Institute of Medicine report on the quality of care in the U.S. in 2001 was called Crossing the Quality Chasm. Our April 2011 issue was called Still Crossing the Quality Chasm, if not suspended over the quality chasm, because we clearly have we've made a lot of progress, as articles in that issue noted. We've had enormous success, for example, in almost national campaigns to reduce bloodstream infections that are acquired in hospitals. That's been very successful. But at the other extreme, there are lots of areas that we haven't made that much success in. Mark Chasson, the head of the Joint Commission, noted at our briefing as we unveiled the issue that there are still 40 wrong site or wrong patient surgeries a week in this country. 40. Now, after all the attention that has been devoted to this, you would think that it would be zero or maybe one.
Yeah.
And then you think about all the other industries. You know, there aren't 40 plane crashes a week in the U.S. There aren't 40 planes that arrive at the wrong destination. Why are there 40 wrong site or wrong person surgeries? And, you know, one of the scariest ones of these that I heard about recently was a patient, the wrong side of whose brain was operated on.
Gosh.
You know, this is just intolerable. And not only is it intolerable and just you know, produces a sense of revulsion in all of us when we think about it, it costs a lot of money. You know, if you have a patient who has an error, is the target of an error, that patient is likely to stay in the hospital longer. That means more health care spending that we all, in essence, eventually pay for. So getting a grip on this becomes really important. And as another article in our issue showed, even at some of the best institutions in the country, this remains a problem. We featured one article that looked at the results of doing a very extensive medical records review at three of the most advanced hospitals in the country for 1 month in October 2004. And it turned out that even in those institutions, one out of every three admissions was involved in an adverse event of some sort. So that's a pretty high rate of error, in effect, and something obviously we have to come to grips with.
Great examples and cause for optimism. Today we've been speaking with Susan Dentzer, Editor-in-Chief of Health Affairs, the nation's leading journal on health policy. Susan, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations.
Great to be with you.
We close with the Tech Report, our weekly look at how people are using technology to improve health and wellness. I'm Lauren Bonner. Over a year ago, the Techs for Baby campaign was launched to provide expectant mothers with information that can improve their health and the health of their babies via text messages. Not only is the service free, but through an agreement with mobile operators through the efforts of the Wireless Foundation, messages from Text for Baby do not count against a person's messaging plan. To sign up, expectant mothers send the message Baby to Text for Baby to receive messages in English. If they send Bebe in Spanish, they will receive messages in Spanish. They will get age and trimester-specific information for the pregnancy.
That's Lauren Bonner with this week's edition of the Tech Report. If you have questions for Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, or would like to subscribe to the Conversations podcast, you can visit them on the web at chc1.com. The Health Forum is part of Connecting Our Communities from Connecticut Public Broadcasting in partnership with area nonprofits, and production support for Conversations on Healthcare has been provided in part by Community Health Center Incorporated. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.